Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
At some point in our life, we learn to appreciate the finer things. Small batch, top shelf, handcrafted, American made. Something you can touch, smell, and feel. The kind of experience you won't get with the click of a mouse or a swipe of your touchscreen. It's real. It's Jacques. Jacques is America's only luxury nudie magazine. For those of us who know the good old days are happening here and now. A full-featured erotic magazine boasting full-page nude pictorials of real, beautiful women in America today were never retouched. And unlike anything you've experienced before, framed with edgy editorial, outspoken opinion, and effortless class, Jacques is the magazine your father kept hidden under his mattress, but you display proudly on your coffee table. Appreciate the finer things. Discover Jacques. The world will never be the same again. Visit jacques-mag.com. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am very excited for today's guest because we're going to be talking about stuff that is both professional and personal. And sometimes I bring you guests who are very academic and we discuss the very cerebral things. And then we have other guests where we're talking about personal life. And in this particular episode, you're going to get a little bit of both. I am very excited to introduce to you Dr. Simon Rokhdi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fabulous. And thank you for being here. I know that you are a little bit sick, so thanks for that, for coming anyway.
My pleasure.
It's given me a little bit of sexy voice, though. I appreciate it.
Yeah, actually, that sounds more like stilted voice to me, but we'll work with it.
Oh, it's going to be good. It's going to be good. So you are an assistant professor of philosophy and women's and gender studies at Westchester University, correct?
That is correct.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit first about that as a field. What is it that makes you excited about those things? What do you care about? What do you want to do with your work?
Well, it depends on which one we're talking about. When it's philosophy, I focus mostly on aesthetics. I teach philosophy and film, and I also teach ethics, which are the funnest courses. And then for women's and gender studies, I do a lot of intro classes and then queer theory. So sexuality studies, queer theory, that kind of stuff. And then the reason I like teaching that stuff is honestly because you get students who've never talked about it. All of a sudden they show up in your class and you change their entire perspective on things. So you watch students go from thinking the world is one way to having this moment of just sort of cognitive collapse. And then they start rebuilding and going to a better place. So it makes teaching exciting each semester. And it's fun.
That's a really good point about how when somebody walks into a math class or something, like you could change their lives.
But somehow that formula is probably not going to change the way they view the rest. I mean, it could. And I mean, if I figured out how to do math, I'd probably feel like my whole world had been changed. But I think it's less common.
Yeah, or maybe I just don't know enough about math to know about the world-changing experience of finally understanding calculus or something. I don't know. Not my degree. But yeah, I can attest to the personal experience of having taught, especially at like an undergrad level, at a community college especially, the work there feels like so tremendously impactful and like to spend two or three class sessions probably explaining the difference between like sex and gender.
Yeah. And how long it takes for it to sink in. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it makes sense to me that it takes a really long time for my students to comprehend the difference between sex and gender, because even for those of us who get the differences, we always catch the ways in which they're not different. And so you've got students who their whole lives have been told that sex and gender are the exact same thing. You tell them they're different, and then by the end of the semester, you're like, actually, surprise, they may not be all that different after all.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Like, what would be a way in which they're not that different after all?
Well, if you think about, I used to use, and I always use myself as an example when I'm teaching, because it prevents us from using people who aren't there to be able to voice their experiences, mm-hmm. from being objectified and sort of manipulated. It also holds students accountable to being respectful in the way that they're talking about an individual's gender identity, and it prevents them from each individually giving their own personal experiences and anecdotes. So I tend to focus on myself, and I used to talk about, that I could be an assigned sex at birth, but my gender doesn't necessarily line up. And so if I was assigned female at birth, and my gender clearly didn't line up with female from the time I was born, my parents had even noted this, it didn't line up, I could say very clearly, you can see the distinction between sex and gender. But during my process of teaching at Westchester University, it became quite clear that actually that probably wasn't really true for me, that I was more than likely, though we'll never know for sure, born intersex. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of every semester, I've always brought in intersex. And when I brought in intersex, I did it in a really careful way where we talk about being born neither distinctly male nor female, not as a way to think of intersex as a challenge to the gender binary, but as a way to say, hey, our obsession with the gender binary has these really negative impacts on intersex people, really profoundly physically and emotionally violent impacts. And so I'm teaching about this, and while I'm teaching about this, I discover that, oh my God, I was actually probably born intersex. And so I had this moment where I realized, wait a minute, what are the chances that my experiences with my gender weren't impacted by some sort of, whether it's hormonal or genetic connection to maleness? And I could easily dismiss that and say that's a coincidence. But then when you look at the number of intersex people who are born intersex and then assigned typically female by the doctors and then grow up all their lives feeling like they're trapped in the wrong body. And so when that happens, then you have to start thinking, there seems to be some sort of biological impetus for connecting with a certain gender performance. And I'm not saying that gender performance, because clearly gender performance is socially constructed. If it wasn't, we wouldn't see these shifts in gender, the way we present gender from, say, 17th century France to the way it manifests in 19th century America, the way it manifests in 20th century Japan. And those wide varieties of gender presentation tell us that it's socially constructed. But the fact that you have people that are assigned, reassigned a sex at birth, and yet they persist to pull toward what would be a conventional understanding of their birth sex, right? And the gender presentation for their birth sex, to me that seems to indicate that there might be some connection, one that we just don't quite understand. I guess, to be honest, the reason why I push my students to think that there might be a connection between biological sex and gender is because without that connection, it makes it very difficult to explain the trans experience. Mm. My students are very quick to take this sort of trans-exclusionary radical feminist approach, which is to say that people who are transitioning from one sex to another, from one gender to another, are just refusing to give up on gender binaries. And I don't think it's that simple. And so part of that conversation involves asking, are sex and gender entirely and completely separate? And I don't necessarily think that they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah. To give this a little bit more specificity as opposed to just being concepts, can you talk a little bit about your own experience and how you're now coming to a different understanding, and how you came to believe that you're intersex?
Yeah, I mean, for me, interestingly, it happened as a result of giving birth. So I had been raised Mormon, and as a very young child, I was always pushed to be a traditional girl. And I remember when I was very young, I was confident that I would figure out that somebody would figure out that I was supposed to be a boy. My mother, when she got over the anxiety around me being gay and being masculine, actually reminded me of a story from when I was maybe three, where I'm standing at the top of the stairs and yelling to her, and when she comes to the stairs, she said she looks up and I've got my pants down and I'm saying, "Mom, I found my penis, it's right here." And of course, my mother didn't say, "No, that's your clitoris," she just said, "It's not a penis," and she ran away, right? It would have saved me a lot of trouble had she told me what it actually was. But all of my family remembers that period of time up until about six of me being confident that God would fix the mistake and would make me a boy. But at six is when Mormons start preparing for baptism. And so my family had a meeting, because we're a big family, you actually have family meetings. It's the only way to make it work. And so they had a family meeting where they all decided that I needed to start acting more like a girl. I remember my father was the only one who thought it wasn't that big of a deal. And I remember this part very clearly because somebody said something about being embarrassing because I would go out in the backyard. My brother and I would have fake weddings, and he would marry Wonder Woman, and I would marry either Dolly Parton or Farrah Fawcett. And so somebody had pointed this out, and my dad says, "Well, what can you say? She's got good taste in women." And so he thought it was funny. And later he wouldn't think it was so funny. But at the time, I was just a tomboy. It wasn't that big of a deal. But I remember at six that was when we all decided that I would start being normal. And so they started making me wear more girls' clothes. I got a perm. And I got a perm for like 10 years after that. It was an absolute nightmare. And I remember the doctors when we would go. My mom would go in for a checkup or something. I remember our family doctor would always tell me that that I would always be an ugly kid, that I would never be attractive, that there was nothing my mother could do about it, but that she would have to help me be a real girl, that all she could do was make me be more feminine. And so I remember this pressure that my mom was put under, and she's talked about it, the pressure she was put under to make me more normal. And my mom's response, because I was big and like bulky, she would diet me. So she started me on diets from about the age of seven. And for a long time, I resented her about it. But in hindsight, of course she did. You know, she has everybody telling her that I will be an outcast if she doesn't make me more feminine. Well, I didn't look feminine because I was big and bulky. And so I had, after a while, it took a while to really internalize this. And by the time I was, 16, 17, I was just like every other genderqueer kid. I was suicidal. I was depressed. I was miserable to be around. I don't know how anybody could stand me. And finally, my father, when I was 17, took me for a ride. And he's like, "Liz, you've done what we've asked. You've worn your hair long. You've worn makeup. You've worn girls' clothes. And you're miserable." He says, "And even when you're wearing those clothes, you still look like a gay boy in drag." And he goes, "Not how I'd have put it, but yeah, basically I want you to go cut your hair, buy boys' clothes." So for my father, this Republican Mormon from Idaho, to say that, you can imagine that he was sort of desperate. And so I did that, and almost immediately I was happier. And within a couple of years, I was social, had friends, I enjoyed life. And so I think that for my parents, regardless of their ideological beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, that was enough for them to, as best as they could, get behind it. And so I had always known that I was genderqueer, but then I go to this women's college, and I finally feel like myself there. In hindsight, and talking to some of my friends from college, it was because they didn't treat me like a girl. They treated me like a boy girl or a boy. And so I was very comfortable there, but I worked very hard to accept myself as a female who was just masculine. Then I get pregnant, and when I'm pregnant, I get really, really sick. I mean, sick to the point where the doctors can't explain what's going on. I spend weeks in the hospital in my second trimester, and I mean, it's just like my son was like a parasite who's trying to kill me. And he's perfectly healthy, but I'm friggin' dying. And I would be in the hospital, and I would get up every day and do my exercises, just walking through the hospital. I'm emaciated. My head's just kind of swaying on my shoulders. And I would go in, and I would always walk past where they keep the babies. And the nurses would always, like through the windows, they'd be teaching me like swaddling tricks or proper way to hold a baby or how to burp a baby. And I'd be standing there watching with my IV feeding tubes, like, you know, up on the cart. And people would walk in, they'd be like, "Oh, look at the proud daddy. Which one's yours?" And I always point to my stomach, and they'd be like, "Oh, he's such a funny guy. Watch out for that beer gut." And they'd walk out. So here I am, 8 months pregnant, and people are still reading me as a guy. So I have my son, and I get better, but I don't get really better. And within about 2 years, I'm so sick that I can barely walk. I have a hard time getting out of bed. I'm in so much pain that I just can't function. So they think, okay, you've got MS. They rule that out. You've got Lyme's disease. They treat me for that for 3 months before they finally rule it out. They're thinking you've got a brain tumor. You've got some form of cancer. They can't find anything, and they're about to give up. And my neurologist is like, "So, let's talk. I've done some research, and I don't think this will offend you, but when I look at you, I see a male body. Other than your genitalia, I think male. What if you were born borderline intersex, but because you had reproductive organs, they didn't give you an official diagnosis as intersex?" So he has me call up my mom and ask her some questions. And when we're talking, my mom, she says, "Well, yeah, as soon as you were born, the doctor said you'll never give birth, you'll never have children." I was like, "As an infant?" And she said, "Yeah, they said you'd never have babies." And I remember that my doctor used to talk about how I'd never have children, and that had always bothered me because I wanted to have kids. And as we, you know, she starts answering these questions, my neurologist is like, "I think you were born intersex." It was 1974.
Why did the doctor say that initially when you were born?
We don't know. In fact, when I was 18 and I was getting ready to go to college, I knew I would be, my parents and I were having problems about me being gay. And so I went to collect all my medical records because I knew I'd be leaving and I didn't think I'd come back. When I went to get my medical records, I remember the nurse, who was the same nurse the entire time I was, my entire life. She walks up and she whispers in my ear, "I know what you're looking for, but you're not going to find it. He got rid of all those records."
Whoa.
And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I remember asking my parents and them saying, "I don't know what that's about. It's really weird. There's nothing to tell you." So when I mentioned that to my neurologist, after I talked to my mom, because we'd remembered that, he said, "Yeah, you know, that's pretty common," because doctors back then, on their own volition, would start, quote unquote, treating intersex patients, even though they had no knowledge of what they were doing. And then when people started getting in trouble, they just eliminated all the documents.
What do you suspect that included? What do you think happened?
I mean, it could have been simply that maybe when I was getting shots, he was giving me shots. Maybe, you know, my mom says, "I don't remember that you had more. You went in for more shots than anybody else. But then again, I had six kids and you were number five. So you could have been getting more shots. I just don't remember." And he may have done nothing. He may have simply eliminated the fact that he hadn't told anybody what was going on. Or that nurse could have just been off her mark. I have no idea. And we'll never know. But what I do know is my neurologist said, "Why don't we try something? Your next step is an electric wheelchair. You can't walk anymore. You can't get out of bed without help." I'd had to move into a house that had the ability to put in ramps so that we could have completely handicap access to the entire house. And he says, "Let's try testosterone." He said, "I've already reached out to some endocrinologists, and I can't find any that will treat you because they're going to want to normalize your body to be more feminine." He says, "I think that'd be the worst thing. So let's figure out a way," and we did, "to get me testosterone." So it took me about 6 months to be willing to try it. It got to the point where, I mean, I was breaking canes just trying to walk. I was crying, getting out of bed. It was so, the pain was so unbearable. So I finally decided, "I'll go ahead, we'll try this." Within a couple of days of my first shot, I could walk. It took only a couple of weeks, maybe three at the most, before the pain had disappeared enough that I could function day to day. And now, if I don't have my weekly testosterone shot, the pain comes back and walking becomes, at times, it's probably, the pain is probably nowhere near as bad as it used to be, but it's so much worse than it is now that it's almost unbearable.
So medically, what is it doing for you?
I have no fucking clue. I don't really care. Ooh. You know, and the thing is I, like, my endocrinologist And other doctors have been like, let's go in and get you tested. Let's see what's going on. But if they do that, then especially with the history of endocrinology, my fear is that they're going to say, now let's pump you full of estrogen and see what happens. I don't want to have that happen. They're going to say, let's take you off the testosterone. I don't want to do that. There are changes to my body that are weird for me, but being able to navigate life, to be able, being able to teach without wincing in pain, you know, stand up and be able to walk back and forth in the classroom. I used to have to sit in a chair and move around in this lifted chair on wheels, just to teach. And I would have to type using assisted, so speech to text software, because my hands hurt so much and my arms hurt so much I couldn't type. And all of that disappeared with the testosterone.
Wow.
You know, but if you think about testosterone, deals with pain regulation and energy, right? And those are the two things that were causing me the most problem. And that went on for 3 years, almost 3 years, before my neurologist suggested this. And I don't ever want to go back to that.
I feel like this is something that they would want to write up if they talked about that.
Actually, yeah, my endocrinologist and my rheumatologist were, you know, they're like, because my rheumatologist, she didn't think it was a good idea. But then after she saw me a couple months after my first shot, she's like, oh my God, we got to get together and write a paper about this. But then she had the same reaction my neurologist did, which was, but if we do that, people are going to want to study you and you've been through enough. We're not going to do it. You know,
but it could also be helpful because who
knows? To a lot of people, right?
Who else is doing the same thing and doesn't have a neurologist who
stumbles
upon this idea?
Is that testosterone is precisely what they give men for fibromyalgia, which is sort of the default diagnosis I'd been given. But they haven't cleared testosterone for treating women with fibromyalgia. And it's not that they don't think it will help them. It's that they won't clear women for testosterone for fibromyalgia. And there have been some almost anecdotal studies using testosterone for women. The biggest problem becomes what happens to the secondary sex characteristics that get affected by the testosterone, and how many women are willing to essentially alter their sex presentation in order to get rid of the fibromyalgia symptoms.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. I mean, so it's essentially like what sort of stuff? It's going to be like hair.
Facial hair.
It's going to be...
voice drops. Your weight changes. So I've lost significant amounts of weight, but body fat, but I've gained significant amounts of muscle. And so just the shape of my face, the shape of my body. I always look like a guy, but now I have a hard time convincing people I'm not. Like I had a guy hitting on me outside of the bike stop, outside of a leather bar in Philly the other night. And at some point in the conversation, I figured out where it was going. And I made some mention of me being a female. And he looks at me and goes, so you have a penis, right? And I said, no, I was born female. So then your penis grew in after that, right? And I said, no, I don't have a penis. He says, but you don't have a vagina. Yeah, I have a vagina. He goes, but you still have a penis, right? You know, I mean, it just went on and on. It wasn't until my girlfriend came out and he says, your boyfriend's really hot. And she goes, yes, yes, she is. And he goes, oh no, right? It's that hard for people to accept it. And so I imagine for, say, a cisgendered heterosexual woman to say, I'm going to either live a life of pain and limited mobility, or I'm going to become, for all intents and purposes, a man. Mm-hmm. That would be a really hard decision to make.
Yeah. How do you decide, and how did you come to a decision, like what gender pronouns you wanted to use and the name that you go by?
Simon actually had nothing to do with the name. When I was in college, you know, I was raised Mormon, so by the time I got to college, I really didn't know how to drink. And I'd got invited to some parties in my first couple of weeks there. And at the first party, somebody gave me something to drink. It was in a 2-liter bottle, looked like soda pop. And they said, oh, it's just a great flavored alcohol. It's fine. So I drank it. The more I drank, the thirstier I got. The thirstier I got, the more I drank. And I got totally shit-faced. And it turned out it was Everclear.
Oh.
And so no. I was like sloppy, messy drunk, and I was so embarrassed that I swore off drinking until I could learn how to drink responsibly. And I got invited to a party with a bunch of really cute, straight senior women. And so I wasn't drinking, and they wanted me to play drinking games. And I said, you know what? We'll play Simon Says, and I'll be Simon. That way you guys drink and I don't. And by the time we were done, all anybody could say was Simon. And a couple weeks later, the college president saw me on campus. She's like, everybody calls you Simon. Can I call you Simon? And once that happened, that was it.
So that's cute.
That was my name. It was in a way about gender identity. It was a women's college, and I clearly wasn't like the other women there, and my classmates respected that. The Simon thing has always been there.
How about pronouns?
Pronouns, I think I was far more loose about pronouns than I ever realized. I didn't even notice it, but apparently even back in college, I used to inadvertently refer to myself as he, and I'd never noticed it. But I'm not particular about pronouns. And in fact, I'm working on my tenure application right now, and I was going through some of the recommendations and some of my evaluations. Some say she, some say he, and some say they. And I can be teaching a class, and half the students are saying he, and the other half are saying either she or they. And they will have a perfectly reasonable conversation switching my pronouns around. It works really well.
And do you have any particular feeling on it?
Nope.
It's all good?
No, it all works for me. As long as they don't say it, I don't care.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's a reasonable line to draw. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about intersexuality in general. So are things better now? I don't know what it's like for the average person at a hospital. I don't know what most doctors know now and what their plans are now.
So a couple of times I've been asked to speak to medical professionals about their treatment of intersex patients. And it's really hard for them because their textbooks still refer to them as hermaphrodites. It still refers to people who are intersex. Those books still refer to them as a social medical emergency that needs to be addressed right away. However, the American Medical Association has new policies on it that say you can no longer go in and immediately start messing with hormones or performing surgeries, that you have to wait a couple of years, and that the family has to go through counseling that shows them all the alternatives. Doctors are still more likely, as I understand it, to encourage the transitioning of an intersex child, typically to female. But that's because they're afraid of any child growing up with an imperfect penis. But of course, an imperfect vulva or vagina is perfectly fine. So it is much better. But the problem is we live in such a binary world that people can't fathom what it would be like to grow up not clearly male or female. As I understand it, parents are more and more opting to raise their children as intersex, which I think is great. I think that's what we should be doing. But I can understand why parents would be afraid to do it because of just how kind of absurd we are when it comes to gender regulation in our society. So parents panic.
What does it mean to raise a child as intersex? Like, what would that look like in day-to-day life?
I think so. I do this exercise with my students when we cover intersex, where I put them into untenable positions, and they have to debate a position where on like one side I'll give them, you must transition the child to female and give it feminine pronouns and raise it as a girl. And the other side, I say you have to defend your position to raise the child as intersex without pronouns. And what they find is, as they debate this, is that neither position is going to be healthy for that child. That at some point the kids, because of what they're encountering, are going to have something to anchor themselves to, whether that's a gender-neutral pronoun or a masculine or feminine pronoun. They've got to have something. The other option is just, it really amounts to, in my opinion, a lot of psychological and physical torture throughout their lives. And so I hope that they come to the conclusion, though I don't think they always do, that it would be better to raise your child as intersex and help them sort of navigate the ambiguities and the pressure from society. But if you're going to raise your kid as intersex, you have to be prepared to have really open conversations with your kid about the ways in which the body's different. Or maybe their body isn't different now, but it will be when they hit puberty. Right? To help them figure out, do they want to have a traditional pronoun? Can you make it so it's comfortable for them to not have a traditional pronoun? Do they want to spend the rest of their life living as intersex, or are they going to want to transition at some point in their life? I think it means a lot of work for the parents, but a lot more work for that kid. And the biggest problem is not the parents, it's not the kid. There's nothing wrong with the child. It's their classmates, it's their parents, the parents of their classmates, it's their teachers. They're the ones that have no idea what they're doing. They're the ones that are imposing a whole bunch of myths and have no actual knowledge. That's what's going to make it hard for those kids.
It's going to be like bathroom, locker room, sports teams arbitrarily telling kids that they can't be involved in stuff.
Right. And, you know, and you can imagine that it's the amount of torture that the kid's going to face. Depend, you know, are they going to be, people going to assume that they're assigned male, assume that they're assigned female, and what kind of pressure are they going to experience? And then there's this whole assumption that it's on the shoulders of that kid or their parents to make all the other kids and parents comfortable, right? As opposed to those kids and parents doing the work to become comfortable on their own. And so it's better, but it still sucks.
I'm also curious how sexuality education is different. Like, for one thing, I have an issue with the model where we put all the boys in one room and the girls in another room and they have to learn different stuff. I remember a day I was teaching undergrads, and it's a class that's normally PE, but I was asked by the head of the department to do a sexuality education day at least once during the semester. And I am talking about contraceptives and something like that, and there was a boy who had kind of just been a little bit of a douche rocket all semester anyway, was like, do I have to be here for this? And I was like, why wouldn't you be? Because it's like, this implication is either that, like, only women need to know about contraceptives, and that every single woman does need to know about contraceptives, and, like, why, what? What? But, I mean, yeah, so how do we address, like, for issues like that? I mean, when we make sexuality education about just avoiding pregnancy and STIs, you know.
But I think we also know that when we have sexuality education being about avoiding pregnancy and STIs, that actually just tunes kids out. And if we don't talk to them about what sex is really about, then we're actually not effectively educating them, right? And so you can imagine if we actually started teaching kids about sex in a way that's not so genitalia-focused and not so endgame-focused, that you would have kids that start to realize that maybe actually fucking isn't what they want to do right now, but there are all these other things they can do. When they think that there's just one set of genitals that they're going to encounter. I mean, the fact of the matter is that even if you're not considered intersex, you're considered distinctly male or female, your body is still somewhere on a spectrum of maleness and femaleness. All that anxiety we have about our bodies and our sexual anatomy is often about whether or not we properly measure up to what is male or female. Can you imagine if we were doing sex ed where we talked about not just sexuality, but biological sex as something on a spectrum? We'd have a lot of kids that were far less anxious about whether or not their dick was big enough or their labia were too big, right? All of a sudden, they would actually wouldn't try so hard to prove their manhood or their womanhood through sexual encounters. However, the people who are making those decisions are really insecure about the size of their penises, right? And so they don't want to have these conversations.
This is reminding me of, earlier today, I posted an article that was, it was about why I love having sex with men with small penises, right? And I posted it, not necessarily agreeing with every word of it, but, like, you know, interesting perspective. And someone, I'm so glad, pointed out one of the things that was problematic about the article was it wasn't just like small penises are great. It was because they don't feel super confident and cocky, they have to try so much harder. And sort of comparing it in the same way that, like, you know, fat girls try harder in bed. And right. It's just like, because they're not good enough, which is like, ooh.
I'm willing to sacrifice a good quality penis for somebody who's going to work really hard.
Yeah. Which is...
It's really funny. One of the things that I do is I work with fraternity guys a lot. And I started working with fraternity guys just as I was getting sick. And so I still presented more as a woman, though it was still confusing for them. But one of the things I used to tease them about was that somebody had to bring in a Butch Dyke in order to teach them how to be real men. I thought that was funny. They rarely did. What I've learned from working with them is that, you know, you've got these guys that are actually really sensitive and who just want to be good guys. But their fear is always that women will think that they're lesser if they're sensitive. And I thought that that was just a bunch of, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor guy thing, which and actually a lot of it is. Let's not kid ourselves. They feel a lot of self-pity in ways that they shouldn't. But when that started coming up, I brought it up in my classes, and I would say stuff about it, and the women in my classes would be like, well, yeah, I'm not going to date a guy who cries at the movies. Or, you know, if he's got a small penis, then what's the point? And as we'd talk about this, and I'd look at the faces of the guys in the classroom, I'd think, holy shit, the pressure on these guys to be perfect, real men, that's intense. It's no wonder they're constantly overcompensating and failing brutally to achieve any sense of, like, real manness. And, you know, and so then when we get to the stuff on intersex, I'll walk them through a scenario. Actually, I learned from my mom when she was working as a physician's assistant, secretary for a physician's assistant program, where a couple of the students had been sent out on a internship with a country doctor. And a patient comes in, and the doctor was surprised that she'd come in because he'd never really seen her. She was born out on her farm, you know, a very devout Mormon girl. But she was about to get married, and she wanted to talk to her family doctor. And when she came in, she said, I need an exam. And in the process of the exam, they discovered quite quickly that she has a very rare form of intersex, which is that she has a fully developed penis, fully developed a vaginal cavity. And she says, I'm about to get married in the temple. And for Mormons, that means not just you're married for life, but you're married for all eternity. She says, I don't know how to tell my fiancé. And so, you know, the doctor has to grapple with what to do with the situation and helps her figure out how to tell the fiancé. And so I ask my students, what would you do in that situation? And they'll all kind of sit there and say, well, I don't know. I don't know what I'd do. And say, she should have told me from the beginning, right? And after, they would always say, well, I couldn't marry her because she lied to me. And that was always their cop-out. And I knew it was more about the genitalia, that was the real issue. So I started telling that story, and then I shifted and I said, let's talk about a hypothetical. You get stranded after spring break, and you get a layover somewhere in Texas, and you leave the hotel that you're staying at, and you go to a local bar, and you meet this person. Like, for the guys, you meet a woman. For the woman, you meet a man. And you hit it off right away, and you discover that this person lives just 20 minutes from you. And so you start, you know, texting each other, and you friend each other on Facebook and all the ways that you all date these days. And then you start going out, and it's moving really quickly, and you're quickly in love, and you're meeting each other's parents. And you haven't had sex yet, but you like it that way. It's working. And then one day, the person you're dating says, hold on, I need to go take my shot. And you're like, what, you're diabetic? And they're like, no, I'm not diabetic, it's my hormone shot. And then all of a sudden, it hits you. And you say, why didn't you tell me? And the person says, what do you mean, why didn't I tell you? You met me in a gay trans bar. How did you not notice you were in a trans bar? I thought you knew this whole time. And you look at them and say, because when I saw you, I stopped looking around at the bar. I was just looking at you. Now, my question for you is, do you marry this person? And my students will, I mean, they'll sit there and seriously contemplate it. Is the genitalia of a person enough to dictate your ability to love them? And some students will say, I don't care. If I love the person, that's all that matters. And other students will say, and I think honestly and fairly, but part of what I desire in sex with somebody is their genitalia, right? And so it creates an interesting conversation where they have to deal with the complexity of what we desire. Is it a person's personality? Is it their sex anatomy, right? Is it the way they present themselves? You know, what is it about people that makes us want to fuck them? And not even just fuck them, but spend the rest of our lives or a long period of time having sex with that person. And I want to, and part of me wants to look at my students and say, how can you suddenly stop loving a person because their genitalia doesn't look the way you want it to? And I'll point out to them, I'm like, does that mean that before you go on a date with somebody, you say, you know what, I think you're great and I'd love to go out to dinner with you, but can you drop your pants so I can measure your penis? Or so I can check whether or not I'm attracted to your labia. You know, doesn't that seem a little shallow and ridiculous? You wouldn't do that. But then my students will say, and I think fairly so, they say, yeah, but there's a range of things that I can work with. And there are some things that are just a turn off for me. I don't know why I brought that up, but it always makes me curious as to how we do that.
In the Mormon analogy, the thing that comes to mind, and especially when there's sort of a religious sense of waiting to do sexual things until marriage, the idea partly being that it shouldn't be about comparison shopping, that you should use the marital union to do all of your learning about sex.
Right, and you negotiate everything, including sex, because that's not the focus of your relationship. It's the spiritual focus, right? So,
but then it seems like, particularly in that situation, you should be like down for whatever happens, because that's sort of like you're basically playing some kind of like, you know, choose one Russian of the three rabbit. Doors. Yeah. Like there's a goat behind one of them, you know, like, yeah. And like, you don't, I mean, that's what you are choosing, yep, through one of those lifestyles is, right, to say, I have no idea what's going to happen. You might have absolutely no abilities sexually whatsoever. And I am game for that because, yeah, like, that's my religious belief. And so it seems like in that situation, if you say no, you're actually denying your entire ideology.
Right. The entire, you're saying that that's not really the reason I'm getting married. And in that case, the guy did choose to marry her. I mean, he knew in advance that she couldn't get pregnant because that's something she knew. I don't think, from what I understand, that she really comprehended how different her body was. That wasn't something that she had any reason to know.
Yeah.
So when the boyfriend found out, he was like, I still love her. It doesn't matter. We always have planned to adopt. I don't care. But my students have a really hard time getting over the idea of betrayal, as if somehow not divulging the most intimate details of our bodies is a betrayal to the people that we're in relationships with, like that they have the right to know everything about us.
Wow, yeah, that's an interesting point, too. Okay, so this is a thing I think is a common question, and it's like sort of interchangeable, whatever the topic is. At which point are you supposed to tell partners whatever,
yeah,
right? So at which point do you have to tell someone that you have a kid, that herpes, that, yeah, you're divorced, that like you...
You had 10 partners or 2 partners or 50 partners.
You're a sex worker or, yeah, whatever. When do you tell
or
all these things?
You're a Republican. I mean, when the hell do you tell somebody that? Jesus. I feel like you should tell that in advance, actually.
I feel like I'm going through help for it. So I'm seeing a professional and
I'm
going to groups.
I'm detoxing right now.
I am joining the socialists. It's fine. Yeah, like how... Like, these are all things that, like, I personally... And I feel very comfortable, you know, diving myself out for my things, because I'm really grateful for you talking about your personal experience. Like, I have a whole list of things that disqualify me, you know, in the minds of partners. Now, anyone listening to this is probably going to be cool with most of them, but I never know until I specifically say them, right? So I have to, like, from, like, parse out, you know, start at the easiest stuff, well, it's, you know, that's always a question is like, do I start with the stuff that's actually most socially acceptable? Like, do I tell people that, you know, I've like sexuality education is a pretty good sorting device.
Yeah.
Like if somebody finds out that you do that, that's really going to clear a lot of riffraff. And I think that my aesthetic also helps too, because like at this moment, you guys can't talk some on the radio, but my hair is like 5 different colors, and you know it's interesting how big of a thing that can be. This reminds me. This is a departure conversation with a sideshow performer who is covered head to toe in tattoos, has like giant swinging pendulous piercings everywhere, you know, just lots of things like that, and is actually not super weird personality wise in any way. Like actually just incredibly like gentle, polite, not particularly radical politically anything, but it's like this amazing sorting device. So you know who not to bother with.
Yeah. And so my problem is I look like a grown up frat boy. In fact, sometimes on campus, faculty members will assume that I'm a student and they'll say, oh, I thought you were like a fraternity guy. It used to be that I could weed people out because I just looked like at first people would think I was a guy, and then all of a sudden I'm a really butch dyke. But now I have to, like that guy outside that bar, I have to go out of my way to find a subtle way to tell somebody that I'm not a guy, you know? And that always gets really awkward because suddenly I've just brought my genitalia into a conversation because I look like a cis dude. Hopefully not entirely, but probably. So
in your experience with dating, how does your appearance affect your experience, like going around trying to meet people and like...
It often sucks.
Okay.
Yeah, because the lesbians are freaked out by it. People who want to date trans men are disappointed that I don't identify as trans.
Why do they care how you identify?
I don't really know. But I think it changes the way they imagine sex will be.
Mm.
I think for a lot of people, it's this, well, what is your problem? Why won't you identify as trans? But if I want to date somebody who's comfortable with my body, I want to date somebody who's not afraid to touch my body. And a lot of women who focus on dating trans men are less comfortable. Not a lot, all of them, but a lot are less comfortable with their bodies. Touching their partner's bodies, and that's not the kind of relationship I want. But I quickly learned that lesbian identified women, even when they liked the masculinity of me, they would look at me and say, you're just too much like a man, I can't do it. And I can understand that. You know, that's, in some ways, it's not even so much looking at me that's the problem, it's the way they're read on the street. And since I tend to date femmes, okay, so I only date femmes, because femmes are very hot, but when they're out on the street, if there was somebody like me, it erases their entire identity, you know? And so that I can imagine is really challenging. It makes it tough.
I can say that I've definitely heard that experience from people, like a few trans men that I know who were lesbian identified before they decided to transition, their partners, like long-term partners, had a really interesting experience of grappling with like, okay, so this changes my identity to the world. Yeah. I'm no longer going to be read as a lesbian. And that's been a thing, a source of pride where I get my community. Am I ready to give up that part of who I am? So that they
And I'll often
can be
hear people
are.
Say, well, you don't have to give up your identity. You're who you say you are.
Yeah.
But our identities aren't really for us. Our identities are a way of communicating who we are with somebody else. Our identities are sort of a sign. It's sort of semiotics. It's a sign that I present to somebody else. And then that other person interprets what I'm presenting. And so if you want people to understand you in a particular way, it's not as simple. I don't get to just simply say, no, I'm a woman, treat me like a woman, or no, I'm a man, treat me like a man. If people can't cognitively grasp that, they're going to continue to do their best, hopefully, to treat me the way I want, but it's not going to be the way I'm asking of them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you can say all you want. Like when I would talk to my students, it's like, so if I'm perceived as a man and I have a girlfriend, is my girlfriend still a lesbian? My students say, well, yeah, she identifies as a lesbian. And I'll say, but will anybody else identify her as a lesbian? They'll say, well, probably not. They'll think she's in a heterosexual relationship. They said, imagine the kind of identity crisis that could cause her, right? Because now what she's presenting to the world is not what they're reading. And it's not because of anything she's doing. It's because of who she's attached to, you know? And so I think that's very complicated, very hard to deal with.
This is also sort of related to like femme invisibility in general in queer spaces and bisexual invisibility.
Oh, yeah. In fact, my students, that's the other thing I'll push them is it's like if my students will often answer with, well, people just perceive her as bisexual. I'm like, why? Considering we ignore bisexuality all the time or we try to pigeonhole it as lesbianism or heterosexuality that just can't make up its mind, why would anybody do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have run across too many people being assumed to be bisexual. Yeah,
it's like how many, I mean, the amount of effort we go through to assert our bisexuality and people telling us no, right?
Yeah.
I just don't see how that's going to happen. So
no, you don't,
it's almost like the bisexuality is a way of saying we only like bisexuality when it gets us out of dealing with complex questions. But in actual practice, it's too complicated, so go away. So
I think the bisexuality thing is complicated because it's not just the heterosexual world that just doesn't, it just doesn't occur to people necessarily through just sort of a heterocentric lens. And then there's definitely like gay folks who've had negative experiences with bisexual identified people, either in terms of like, you know, you grew up in Indiana, so you were bisexual for a while before you came out as gay or something, because that's just how you do it there. Yeah. Or, you know, there's just this perception you're more likely to get cheated on or left or something.
Which is really weird because of all the, like, the strictly lesbian-identified people versus the bisexual people I've dated. It's been the lesbian-identified people that were more likely to cheat on me.
Uh-huh.
And not that I think lesbians are more likely to cheat. I just think that there's no way to make that correlation. I don't quite get that.
And then the other thing that I've been sort of curious about, because I've seen the conversation happen a few different times where people are like, why do you use the term bisexual? Don't you consider it to be trans exclusionary? And I'm like, well, yeah, okay, for real, I understand, like, that's an interesting point, and I see what you're saying, but we don't demand that other labels be literal.
Yeah.
Like, nobody is actually from Lesbos.
Right.
Right? Like, and we don't question that. Like,
and we can call people queer as an identity all we want, but you can't use it as a literal identity marker because queerness is, by definition, the defiance of a normative category. So, but we use it anyway.
Yeah.
And we're okay with that.
So I'm just curious, like, why bisexual is held to this, like, etymological standard of literality.
Honestly, and I shouldn't say this because I'm going to have, if anybody listens from my circle, listens this, you're going to get pissed. But I think it's because they're so uncomfortable with the negative stigma attached to bisexual that they'd rather embrace something that's easier, you know, and so they can call themselves whatever, but not bisexual. Which is why I love telling my students I'm bisexual. And then I go and put my hand on a guy. And then, no, I'm just kidding. I never do that. And I'm going out for 10 years, so I swear to God, I never do that.
So the experience of being bisexual with your gender presentation, how has that experience been, like, is it different, like, with women versus, like, dating men? Like,
you know what? Honestly, nobody believes me. It's the funniest thing. They're always just like, oh, that's so nice. And then they just focus on the genderqueer trans thing. Nobody actually ever really engages with me about that, so I wouldn't know. Maybe they believe me, but I don't even think it registers.
They don't believe you about what?
I think they're too busy trying to figure out whether or not I've got a penis or a vagina to figure out whether or not I'm bisexual. You can imagine the extra layer being bisexual would add to the conversation. So
I think it makes intuitive sense. Like, my assumption is that, like, intersexuality and bisexuality kind of make a lot of sense.
Yeah, but the other problem is am I really intersex? We didn't even know that, right?
Okay. Well, I mean, could you find out?
I could probably do genetic testing for about $1,000.
Oh.
And I don't really care to, so.
Oh, okay.
And I wouldn't be surprised that the genetic testing told me nothing.
Okay.
Because if you think about it, intersex could be genetic, it could be hormonal, it could be all these other things. And I honestly don't even know what finding that out would tell me. Because even prior to that, my gender was so difficult to mark that being intersex would just attach some kind of label to it, but it's a label that wouldn't tell me anything.
Maybe it's like when people get genetic testing to find out like the origins of their ancestors, and like, yeah. Does that change how you're read by a cop, you know?
Well, people who have done it have really obsessed about it, and I'm like, it hasn't told you anything, has it? I mean, it doesn't, I mean, it tells you like whether you're more likely to get this disease or that disease, but it doesn't change how you're read by a cop, right?
I mean, I suppose you could have some sense of your personal identity affected by it. Like for instance, this is, again, to use a sort of analogy, not to equate, but an analogy of ethnicity and gender. I spoke with a brilliant woman at a recent conference in Omaha. It was called Teaching Bravely. It was all about educating secondary level, usually. There's a little bit of college teachers. There were some middle school, but talking about challenging subjects. And this one teacher was talking about she is Mexican and a few indigenous tribes and like a mixture of smattering of other things I don't remember. And talking to a mostly white class about the negative effects of assimilation, even for white immigrants. Like asking them to do their little family tree, and like, so you've got the German, you've got your Swedish, you've got your whatever. What the fuck do you know about those? Do you know their languages? Do you know their holidays?
Right.
Do you know their customs, their costumes, anything? What have you lost through assimilation?
Right.
And you still get all this privilege. So can you imagine if you lose all that and also have to experience oppression?
Right.
But
right.
Like, what is the cost?
Yeah, I wonder, sometimes I'll wonder, because I get a lot of pressure to either from, I'll get a pressure from my trans friends to either identify as trans or to clearly not identify as trans, to not appropriate a trans identity that isn't mine. But then I'll also get the other side, which is to identify, which is to embrace a culture that in a lot of ways I benefit from the work that they do. And I work as an advocate for the trans community on my campus. I'm the closest thing we have to a trans faculty member on my campus, or openly trans faculty member on my campus. And so people say, you know, why don't you at least embrace that community and at least benefit from having that community as part of who you are? And that makes sense to me, but the problem is that if I haven't spent my life, I don't know, maybe that's sort of a, I mean, now we're getting into...
But, I mean, you could also have a straight faculty member run the, you know, the GSA.
Mm-hmm. So. Right, so, and I don't feel like I need to identify as trans in order to do that work.
Yeah.
But is it possibly, I mean, I often wonder this, is my refusal to identify as trans, even though I have a very, as been pointed out to me, a very traditional history narrative of... that sounds like a traditional trans identity, looking for the first 5-6 years of my life for my penis to grow in, being convinced that God had made a mistake. All of these things suggest that I was born trans, or maybe intersex, who knows. But so I can't help but wonder, why is it that I refuse to take on that trans identity? And I can give a lot of reasons for it, but I can't help think that possibly it's being afraid of identifying with something that will box me in.
Mm.
And in that way, I think it's very, in many ways, it's different than a racial identity, but that's, I think, one of the ways. Whereas a racial identity is something that whether you want to or not, you are going to be boxed into it, right? And in some ways, your exclusion from your racial identity, because you don't, quote unquote, appear to be your race, is a way of you being boxed in or boxed out of it. But with gender identity and sexed identity, those present very differently in society, and those change throughout our lives in ways that our racial identities don't. And they're not connected to a lineage that is passed on from generation to generation. My mother wasn't trans, my father wasn't trans, my grandparents weren't trans. And so it's not as if you grow up in, are raised in a culture of values around being trans, whereas most often when it comes to racial or ethnic identities, you are. And so part of me feels like I reject it because I don't want to jump into something that feels foreign to me that I'd be locked into. I don't want to deal with the stigmas, you know, which I think is probably weird because the only time I don't identify as trans is when I'm in a group of people that want me to be trans. Whenever I'm in a group of people that don't want me to be trans, I'll really quickly tell them I'm trans, just because they need to hear it. So I don't know what to make of my limbo around gender and sex identity and my lack of interest in figuring out if I'm intersex, but I'm frankly not interested.
So you've never really had the experience of being like a femme, although you went through an experience for years where you were doing the facade. But how do you think having experienced the multiplicities of appearances to the world has influenced your understanding of how people treat others based on their perceived gender?
Well, I can tell you, regardless of how I identify, I have an inordinate amount of male privilege. The difference in the way people treated me, even when they thought that I was probably a guy, compared to how they treat me now when they're convinced that I'm a guy, I get away with so much. I get so much respect. I had colleagues who, prior to me taking testosterone, wouldn't even acknowledge me when I walked into a meeting, wouldn't talk to me when I talked to them. And then I start taking the testosterone, and all of a sudden they're like, hey, would you like to come and present at this conference? Are you interested in being on this committee? Do you want it? And they would be talking over my women colleagues and asking me my opinion. And I'd look at my women colleagues like, did that just fucking happen? And they're like, yeah, it fucking happened. Fuck you. And I'm like, yeah, seriously, that sucked. Like, I get treated so much better as a guy. And so having experienced life as a woman and as genderqueer, and now experiencing life as somebody perceived as a white, straight, cisgendered guy, I have a lot of work to do to sort of give up all that privilege. And to be honest, it's so easy to be me. It takes a lot of reminding to give up that privilege.
So what can you tell cis men, you know, from your experience? Like, what could be helpful for explaining to someone who, you know, for instance, like, it often takes one guy to say a thing that six women have said for it to be taken seriously. You know, so we could talk all day about the experiences that women have of oppression. Like, what can we say then to a cis guy to explain stuff? Because you have this very specific lived experience which you can draw.
Well, like, I'm talking to my male colleagues, and we have a very feminist philosophy department. All the men are very feminist identified. So they'll ask me, they're like, hey, are there ways in which I'm capitalizing on my male privilege? And I'll look at them and I'll say, the fact that you asked that question tells me that you're not. But when we have conversations about it, one of the things we'll talk about is making sure that you're listening to what women are saying in meetings. That if you see a woman being cut off and you jump in, say, okay, hold on a second, and then gesture to the woman who was being cut off and say, I need to hear what you had to say. And then when she speaks, if everybody moves on, then you repeat what she said and say, well, as so-and-so was saying, and then you assert it. When you're a guy in a bar, you make sure that the woman you're talking to wants to be talking to you, that you're asking her about herself. If your buddies are sexually harassing a woman, I talk to my guy students about this all the time. When you see a guy, you know, hitting on a girl and she says, no, you can't buy me a drink, I'll say, what does the guy usually do? And they'll say, oh, he turns around and calls her a bitch. I'll say, right, when he calls her a bitch and he comes over to you and tells her how ugly she is or how fat she is, what do? And I was like, you just laugh nervously. And I said, right, so now you've signaled to every woman around you that you're okay with what he said. Your job at that point is to tell him to shut the fuck up, go over to the woman, say, let me buy you a drink and I'll leave you alone and apologize for your friend. I said, yeah, your friend might get pissed at you, he might punch you, they might call you a pussy, they might call you a bitch, or whatever misogynist language they use, but your job is to give up your male privilege to make him look like an ass and make her feel better. And I don't think, I mean, you guys, they're not taught that. They have no idea that this stuff is even going on until you point it out to them. But when you start saying to them, you just have to pay attention to what's happening to the women around you. After a while, guys are coming up to you and saying, oh my God, you won't believe what just happened. I just experienced this. What am I supposed to do? I think most guys don't want to be a part of that problem. I think some guys are perfectly happy to take advantage of it. Most guys don't. They just, one, don't know how to change it, and two, they're absolutely terrified of being treated like women, and so they don't want to give up their privilege. And they would rather let women be treated like women than be treated like women themselves.
That's a really interesting point. And I've known many guys who, like, got it. Like, they, you know, were feminist identified and very much, like, considered that to be a value of theirs, but still just didn't have, like, the day-to-day lived experience to really, really get it. Like, perfect example, like, you know, a good friend of mine who got that catcalling happens, has heard people say that, whom he trusts, but we were, like, on a bike ride where we were separated just enough by, like, a tree or something that someone hollered at me from the sidewalk, and I just go by, because this is, like, welcome to the world, and then the dude was like, hey, thanks, to the guy, because like, that would have been to him, and then just, like, was, like, really floored for a very long time, for, like, probably, like, 15, 20 minutes, like, I can't believe that happened. I'm like, are you shitting me? That was, like, so...
It was minor, yeah.
It was so typical. And, you know, I've been with male dates where, you know, there was just enough physical distance between us that, like, someone hollered at me, right? Because you don't do it when a guy's standing there, because that's disrespectful to the guy.
Yeah.
So there was enough physical distance between us, and they were paying at a parking kiosk or some shit like that, and, like, some douchebags say some stuff, and then the date will get really, really, really upset. I'm like, you're not upset on my behalf, though. Like,
yeah.
Because you can see that I'm actually unflustered. To me, that's like, meh, I'm just, bleh, you're a bunch of... Yeah. But that's always a really fascinating thing when you actually see it.
Yeah. I got to say that what's really frustrating for me more than when... And I don't think... I've had people tell me this isn't fair, but I don't care. More than when cisgendered males do it, it's when... trans men or MOCs, butch dykes, dismiss the experiences of androgynous or femme women with catcalling or misogyny, or when they behave in misogynous ways themselves. To me, that becomes intolerable, because there's no reason that you shouldn't be able to see what's happening. It's not like you're going to have this moment of, oh my God, I've never seen this before, I've never experienced this before, and a lot of cis guys have never seen it, whether it's, you know, willfully ignoring it, or they just, like you described, never encountered it. But for people who have embodied or lived a life where in which those kinds of sexist interactions have been imposed on them, for them to then choose to turn around and ignore it or engage in it themselves, you know, I'll be out at a bar with my girlfriend and I'll have butch dykes or trans men walk up and kind of front with me. And most of the time they're just trying to get her attention, but sometimes, and that's really gross in the way in which they're doing it, sometimes they're trying to prove to her that they're, you know, better butches or better men than me because I'm not fighting back. And I think, what the fuck is wrong with you that you're more concerned with how I feel about how you're treating her than you are with how you're actually treating her? And that just... When a straight guy does it, I'm just like, you're a fucking dick. But when an MOC or a trans man does it, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, how did you suddenly embrace this kind of privilege and forget to look at the way in which you have power to oppress other people now?
If someone's unfamiliar with MOC, can you explain what that is?
Oh, Masculine of Center. So it's a way of sort of kind of a umbrella term that we often put in with for butch dykes or genderqueer presenting as masculine or androgynous to masculine. And sometimes it will, though I don't tend to use it that way, it'll include trans men.
So this is sort of related. It has to do with drag performance.
Yeah.
Kind of related. So I have had interesting conversations about drag queens and whether... It is an homage to femininity, or whether it is comparable to doing a blackface, which is, of course, you know, like, the, you can't, that's...
that's but, probably problematic on many levels, yeah. But yeah.
But is it the same kind of mockery And then I've also heard folks say the drag's inherently transphobic because...
That's inherently stupid. Yeah, I mean, I have a big problem with that, considering that drag was a way for the trans community to come together and for people to express genders that meant a lot to them, the society said they couldn't have. And so to then say that drag is inherently transphobic would be saying to all these trans men and women who would use drag as a way to be who they weren't allowed to be, that'd be like telling them that they hated themselves. I can see where some drag is transphobic, but I don't think drag in and of itself is, especially because in the genderqueer and trans communities, we're so indebted to the history of male and female impersonation.
And I think one of the points that I always, for me personally, make is that I have seen some really fucking sexist drag.
Oh, God, yeah.
And
if I have to hear another drag queen in Philly use the C word, I mean, I know they think it's funny, but it drives me crazy.
Or the, like, menstruation as punchline.
Oh, yeah.
Or the...
The fish jokes.
Yeah.
That's really popular in Philly. When I was in New York... The queer drag scene would not pull that shit with the fish jokes. If they did, they were making fun of themselves for making those kind of jokes. But here, it's just like, I don't know what the hell they're doing.
Or there's, I don't know, I think about 20 million too many times I've heard there was, I don't even know what the origin of it is at this point, some recording where it's like somebody calls to 911 that their pussy's on fire. And like the first time I was like, why... I don't get why this is funny. It's just you're saying the word pussy. Yeah. But then the more I saw people do it, I was like, first of all, I don't like seeing the same shit done over and over again. And that's stupid. And also, like, what is wrong with you?
I mean, in some ways, what I mean, part of my dissertation was on drag. And so I wrote on John Wayne, drag kings, and Mormon masculinity. And then I threw in... Justin Bond's Kiki thing, just because I felt like it. So I think part of what really bothers me about it is it's sloppy art, right? And drag has the potential to do really radical and not even politically radical, but just as an art form, it can be so radical. And so often what I see is people relying on really trite jokes, sloppy jokes. They're not funny because all you're doing is making fun of a person or a thing that's not yourself, but there's no... So Jose Munoz had written about this theory of disidentification, that what makes queer art really good, whether it's drag or performance art or just stand-up comedy, what makes it so good is that you're simultaneously embracing and rejecting dominant culture. You're embracing and rejecting the identity that's your own. And so it's a loving critique of everything that's hurt you. And so he talks about performers who talk about fantasizing about being with the most racist or misogynist or homophobic of characters, and then they put that character on stage. And they give the audience an opportunity to look at this Aryan Nation character and say, my God, totally hot. I'd totally love it if he fucked me. I hate him. I want him to go fuck himself. And while you're having those simultaneous reactions, you're having a moment of catharsis, but you're also having sort of a healing experience. And I think when we do drag as just sort of punchlines or who can have the best wigs or who can use the exact same language every time to talk about drag performances, I mean, God, I don't want to offend anybody here, but if I hear one more show that is essentially a RuPaul Drag Race kind of show, like, why can't we do anything else? You know, it's what happened to developing more complex characterizations? Why is it that all of a sudden we like bears and that's all we do, right? Why can't we do more? I also think that it becomes... We don't have to think about who we really are as a community. Instead, we think about what we want people to get from us. And since we're performing something that's not ourselves, we don't have to risk putting ourselves on stage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Who do you think is doing it well?
Huh. I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay.
Because, you know, somebody might kick my ass on the way out of here.
Okay.
No, I mean, I could... There are things that I see that I really like. There's some really smart queer stuff that's really intersectional. In other words, it's challenging notions of race and gender and sexuality and class. But I don't see a lot of it in Philly. And I haven't been in New York long enough, recently enough to know what's going on there. I haven't seen Justin Bond's shows recently, but... the stuff that she was doing a few years ago and was brilliant. In fact, Marie Hill is still doing amazingly complex performances of normative masculinity that I think everybody should be seeing. I think it's tough in a city like Philly because there's a limited audience, and the audience has a limited understanding of drag and camp. And cabaret, but also RuPaul's Drag Race comes in and makes everybody think they're an expert on it. But yet they have a really limited perspective of the potential there. So that's my way of talking a lot about and not answering your question.
That works. I also had a conversation with a gay man about the limits of drag kings. And one of the things that he critiqued about the scene is that most of what he had personally experienced was performances where masculinity was kind of the punchline. And it was like usually like a sort of a skeezy dude,
mm-hmm.
Usually sort of like a dirty, like, you know, like just all of the worst stereotypes.
Yeah. Mac, that was my master's thesis.
Okay.
Yeah. I was looking at drag kings in New York when it was first getting started. So back in the mid-1990s, and all of the performances were either critiques of douchey masculinity or they were critiques of racialized masculinity. So they were doing brown face or yellow face or black face, or they were doing fag drag. Like, fag drag was a category that guys were doing where they would do an eroticization or a mockery of gay masculinities. But you never saw a critique of or a performance of perfectly normative masculinity. And so as I interviewed the drag kings, what they would say is, because there's nothing funny about a typical dude. And I'd say, okay, well, what about a positive performance of a typical dude? And they're like, there's nothing positive about that. Right? And so I was like, oh my God. So then how can you get up there and expect us to love your character if you don't love your character? And so that, to me, made the performances really flat. Murray Hill, what I like is, even though he does this washed-up lounge singer, you know, middle-aged lounge singer, he clearly loves the character he's performing. And that comes through. And even when he's making fun of his audience, he loves his audience. And his audience feels good being made fun of by him. And that's what makes that kind of performance so great. But when all you're doing is getting up there and either eroticizing masculinity or mocking masculinity, that lacks nuance. And it's just not good.
Like, I want to see... I just personally haven't seen. I'm sure it does exist. I don't actually get to see a lot of drag kings. They're just fewer.
Yeah.
They're just fewer. And they're not in the spaces where, like, I'm booked or the shows that I see. They're just not. And I personally would want to see, like, a... like a James Bond kind of character, you know, like...
My son does great drag king stuff.
Yeah?
He's a decent drag queen, mostly sort of Dolly Parton, a la that movie with the woman who freezes shit from Disney. but he does, I mean, I would never tell him he's being a drag king because he would get confused and then he'd stop doing it. But he does these impersonations of masculinity. And it's the kind of stuff I did as a kid. You know, to me, Halloween was a time for me, nobody could make me dress like a girl, except at the time my brother lost his costume, and so he got mine, and then I had to be a witch, and I cried like crazy. That was 7. So Halloween was a chance for me to be the kind of guy I wanted to be. So I wanted to be James Bond, or I wanted to be Han Solo. Right? Those are the kind of guys that I wanted to play. I always wanted to be the hero, you know, that was the good, you know, the kind of white knight kind of guy. But we don't see people wanting to do that. And in all fairness, I kind of get why. Because we're sick and tired of these, you know, these white straight dudes coming in and trying to save the world. But I also feel like you can perform that, you can love it, it can be sexy, and you can mock it at the same time. You can, like, critique that sort of attitude. And that's what makes good drag. That's what makes good cabaret.
So, like, 2 weeks ago, I did Justin Bieber drag, and I really wish you could have been there to see it. There's no video. So it was like, because for what, like, it, part of it is just the nature of what I look like. You could put all manner of makeup on me, and I would not, it wouldn't look cute as a boy. As a man, I should say. It wouldn't look cute as a man. I could be a boy. So I tend to be Justin Bieber. No shade to Justin Bieber. I also can kind of dance like him. And so my drag performances around Justin Bieber are around doing hip-hop dance while, like, flirting shamelessly.
Right.
And, like, I would be really, really, really excited to hear your critique of, like, that. Because, like, I don't really know what I'm doing. I haven't seen enough to really know what I'm talking about. But, like, I, you know, I just go out and I, like, pick some girl out of the audience and then, like, just make her feel special, spin her around a couple times, give her a present.
Now's here's where I explain that I'm sick and now I've been drinking. So now I'm going to say one of the biggest problems I have, and I find this is worse with drag kings and drag queens, is they tend to think of creating the performance about their facial expressions or their hand gestures as opposed to having their body really grounded in the performance. And I think Justin Bieber is a good character because the way in which he moves, he doesn't gesticulate with his hands. His face very often is sort of flat, but what he does is he actually moves his body. And so that's a really good one to have you really grounded, but also if you're going to go out and flirt with people, then it allows you to sort of direct that character out to the audience. The only way you can flirt with somebody without being a sleazy douchebag is to actually have some sort of love for yourself performing. And so now you're not violating your audience by flirting with them, by doing the performance. You're actually making them feel good. And to me, that's where it gets exciting and fun, especially if, and I've seen you perform, I doubt you're a hand gesticulator. I think that would work really well.
Oh my God, I wish there was video.
Yeah, you'll do it again sometime. I'll finish my tenure application and I'll actually leave Westchester at home.
All right. So I want people to read all your stuff. I want them to
what
know
stuff?
More. But I don't
oh
know.
My God, don't depress me.
Can they? I mean, like fucking interesting. And I'm like,
I teach
people
on a 4-4 load. Okay. And I spend lots of time with my son and fraternity guys, and it's hard to tell the difference between them sometimes. So I don't do a lot of publishing, though I should. It's just, it's, you know, I focus more on, you know, teaching and chasing my 6-year-old. So
if people want to find out more about you, like, can they read your master's thesis, your dissertation?
I keep getting emails from people asking me to publish it, and I will eventually. But there's not a lot out there right now. I mean, there's stuff out there. I'm just going to pretend like it's not there.
No, okay.
The thing is hard is I've got to figure out what my birth name is, because for a while I only used my birth name because it became too complicated to use my actual name. There's some lots of issues around that as I was moving from New York to Ohio and then back up to Pennsylvania. So, yeah, good luck to them.
Okay. All right. So, since we don't have, like, anything to plug for you.
I don't like plugging anyway.
Okay. Well, do you want to plug anybody else? Who do you think people should go read, follow, like, instead?
So if you're really interested in doing drag and doing queer performance, I want everybody to read Jose Munoz's book, Disidentifications. I make any student who tells me they want to do drag or burlesque, I make them go read that. And I've never met a student who's read it who didn't thank me for it. If you want to see great drag, I suggest going and seeing Liberty City Kings. That's also because I figure I'll get laid tonight. thanks, honey.
Who is fine. Honey? Can we say who honey is?
Lascivious Jane.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Aww.
She's kind enough to put up with my boring professor ass.
Aww. Oh, so cute. All right. I want to super, super thank you for coming on.
My
this
pleasure.
Is great. This is totally great. So I want to thank Dr. Simon Rukti for coming on today. And so I guess just go to Westchester University and go take some courses.
Actually, I've been telling everybody to take your class.
Oh, that's semester. True. That is true. I'm going to be teaching there this semester too. So come to Westchester. We can hang out. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. And thank you everyone for listening. And have a fantastic day. Hey, friends and family of Sex with Timory. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Timory media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithtimory and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Timory, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Timory website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithtimory. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.